following interview is being held on April 14th, 1993, with Walters, a commander, U.S. Coast Guard, retired. The interview is being held in his home in Kodiak, Alaska. Tom, could you tell me a little bit about your how you came to Alaska and when, what year?
I actually began flying with the Air Force in 1971, right after college. Realizing I was going to get drafted, I decided that I wanted to be in rescue helicopters. So after flying years in Iceland, I thought maybe there was a better way, a nicer place of doing the flying in. So I thought of the exchange pilot program with the United States Coast Guard. And they had an opening in Astoria, Oregon in 78. And I applied for it and that was accepted. So I flew Coast Guard rescue missions as an exchange pilot from the Air Force for 3 years. And I liked it so much that I asked for an inter-service transfer. And so I went from then 03 in the Air Force and came straight across as a lieutenant 03 and overnight. Days later, in October of 81, I was received orders to come to Kodiak. It was kind of a spur of the moment type deal because we had a Coast Guard helicopter that crashed. Pat Rivas and his crew were on a night rescue mission up in the Prince William Sound area. And at nighttime, pretty crummy weather, and some believe that he had accidentally dipped his tail into some heavy seas there and it killed everybody. So did somebody with cold weather experience come up in the middle of winter? And since I felt like I owed everybody for letting me in, they said come on up to Kodiak, and I was glad to do it. That came up during that time. I got here around the 10th of October, 81, and that was my first time in Kodiak. Of course, at the time, I didn't realize it was really nothing to compare it with. All of my experiences for rescues had been in Iceland and then off the coast of Oregon. Off the coast of Oregon was mainly the trolling industry or medevacs off the ships going up and down the shipping lanes. So I really had nothing to compare it with. And when I first got here in October, I didn't even realize we had mountains around here because the weather was so crummy. The ceilings were always so low and blowing and snowy that and being new to it, I had no idea. However, my first rescue case up here, when you come to Kodiak, this is one of the few places that a pilot comes up here. It doesn't matter how many years you've been flying or what your rank is, you automatically have to wait 90 days before you can sign for that helicopter or airplane as the pilot in command. And so on the SAR cases, the first SAR cases and stuff, I went for the first 90 days. I went as co-pilot. And the first big case I went on was the St. Patrick. St. Patrick was a vessel that was scalloping out here in our waters. And at one particular night, something like in late November, I think it was, there was a storm that went through, and it was such that it had flushed water over the decks and knocked out the power source, and the vessel went dark. I believe there was like 16 people on board, and most of these people had come up from the lower 48, and I think they originally like started off in Florida and had worked their way all the way up around Panama Canal and up the coast and had finally made the way up here. Then we really weren't used to the cold waters and the types of storms and so on we get up here in Alaska. I don't think they were, because a lot of them, when the skipper told them to abandon ship, they weren't very good at it, and some of them jumped in even without survival suits.
And the water temperature is very cold then.
Yeah, you're talking water temperatures of in the upper 30 degrees Fahrenheit, where you only have, 15 minutes before you start losing dexterity, probably even before then, to where you really can't use your fingers or your hands and so on. The winds were blowing as such that the life raft, when they opened it up, the winds caught it and took it off, and several people jumped after it and so on. And it there was only two survivors out of that happened. The rest of them died. That was my first learning experience and of how bad the winters are up here, and what the seas can be, and really how untrained that a lot of fishermen, especially that come up from the lower 48, were about conditions around here. And that was a real eye opener at the time.
I imagine it was quite dull when 12 people died. It's pretty something.
Well, it really was bad because some of the folks on there were from Kodiak that had hired on when the ship got in here, and I know the parents of one in particular, and yeah, that's a real heartache when you know the family and or you know the people. And it's one thing about the Coast Guard, wherever you go, especially in a community like this where it's small, you get to know the people. And so when somebody goes out, it's not just a fishing vessel, it's people on there that you know, and it really becomes discerning heartbreaking when somebody dies. The sad part about this too was that the vessel never sunk. It was sitting right up here at near Marmot Island. It was close by. The Mayday calls that got off were they didn't say where they were and so on like that. It was turned out to be a real Chinese fire drill, just trying to locate them. And then it was a reminder because the vessel sat right out here for years until the insurance company and everybody decided on what to do with it.
So right off Kodiak, only a few miles from the air station.
Yeah.
So it was a fairly quick response time, but the inexperience of the crew?
Well, it would have been a quicker response time. You had snow showers, and it was nighttime, and it was and not knowing where they were, the crews that went out there didn't locate them. Really finding them was the next morning. And by that time, it was too late, except for two of them. And one of them was a real dramatic survival of this one individual. He had lost some of his foot due to frostbite, but he had survived. And he gave, it was nice that he gave his interview and stuff. And part of the survival tapes that was made or laid by the Alaska, University of Alaska, along with the Coast Guard, he told his story, and so we've got that on tape, which was pretty nice.
Oh, that's great. What do you think was one of the, at that time you were up here, what was the most difficult, the challenge for you as far as flying, and the most difficult rescue you've ever been on?
Probably the biggest problem around Kodiak, which you don't have in most places. Well, it's a combination of things. First of all, as you know, the weather forecasting around here is not very good. The weather systems spin off each other like tops, and the weather forecasters have a real difficult time to determine how these systems are going to move through. And because of that, you might see four or five different systems move through Kodiak within a matter of 12 hours, and so you never know what you're going to run into. And the each side of the island is so different. The north side is different than the side on the Shelikof Straits, where you got winds funneling down through glaciers and mountain passes, and on the other side you may have fog, and on the south side maybe clear. So you never really knew what you were going to be flying into when you took off. You just had to realize that and be prepared that you were going to might fly into something different. So I always carried extra fuel with me. I always carried the maximum amount of fuel, realizing that I may not be able to make it back into Kodiak. I might be able to cross over and go into King Salmon, or gives you a little more flexibility. But the other thing was, is around here is the dark during the wintertime. I mean, it is dark. I mean, you don't have all the big city lights and all the big airways and so on like that that you do down in the lower 48. And so that was another problem. The blackness of the surroundings with the lava type rock, the black rock and sand, isn't a very good contrast. And those days, we didn't have we had night vision goggles. They were the handheld, and they didn't work very, very good. And so normally you didn't use them at all because it would tend to give you more vertigo than anything. So they weren't used very much like we use them now. I could have saved a few extra gray hairs if we would have had them back then. But with the ceilings always so low, and the icing conditions were down, you couldn't get up into above the mountain passes and so on because you were afraid to get that icing. And
so normally
you're flying low down to the water and trying to get through these dark passes and stuff. So it was a combination of things, and you always tended to have, especially the night flights, having to fight the vertigo because of all those combinations of things. And you turn on your nose light, for instance, and all of a sudden you get this flutter of snow showers or rain showers that would give you vertigo.
And vertigo is you can't tell up from down, and you don't know which way your aircraft is in relation to the ground.
Kind of causes your head to spin and look like a drunk if you were walking down the street.
That was
vertigo. Yeah.
So it must have been fairly difficult with no reference to see the ground or where the ceiling was, so you had really no idea except for your instruments where you were flying.
Well, yeah, and that presented another problem because also up here you had Loran, and you had two stations of Loran here, one at Spruce Cape and the other one over here at on the other side of the island, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so close together that it left a lot of void on there, and half the time the system was going off. They finally tried to fix that by adding another navigation system about in 85, and added the Omega to it. And the Omega didn't fly well in icy and snow conditions. So really, you were all right better during the summer when the Omega was kind of backing up your Loran, but you never were quite sure where you are. So your main reference points that you had to really stay on the chart, and you really had to concentrate on where you were. So the navigation around here presented another problem. And of course, where did you train to learn all that kind of stuff? Well, you didn't. And so that's why it was important to suck up all you can during that 90-day time as a co-pilot before they threw you in the briar patch. Rotations around here in the Coast Guard were fast, too. It seemed like a lot of people came up here for that 18-month to 2-year tour because a lot of people didn't want to come up here. They just sort of stayed down in Florida and some of the Traverse City and some of the
nicer
places. Especially
the pilots, huh?
Yeah. And so a lot of the historical things that people learned from their flights didn't quite hand down as quick, so everybody had to kind of learn these problems all over.
So it created a kind of, the people that were flying, just as they got to be salty as they were flying and knowing the area, they'd transfer out. So the people that were training were learning, were just as they learned, they were transferring out.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
We had some good training programs, and we had some old heads that loved to hunt and fish around here and stayed up here for 6-7 years. That was about all you could stay up here as pilots, because the Coast Guard always believed that you had to move around, and they thought it was you were really flipping the coin flying up here in Alaska more than 2 or 3 years, that you needed to move on, and they thought they were doing you a favor, and perhaps they were. We didn't quite see eye to eye on that. But
how long was it after you got here that you had your real difficult flying situation where you had to use your skills to the best of your ability?
Oh, that was a monthly occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, there was always
a vessel that was taken on water at night or was having problems, we'd have to go out and lease drop the watering pump to them. Part running into a rock and again taking on water, something like that. There was medevacs all over the island with different accidents and so on, and that we were constantly going out quite often. So
there were a lot of vessels that sunk during that time.
Yeah, there were. We were on a lot of different searches. During those days, it was when I first got here, that was you could see the downslide of the king crab industry here in Kodiak. And because there was less and less king crab and out there to catch, but there was still as many vessels and families and boat payments and insurance payments and that had to be paid. You had the whole fishing fleet that was still going out to get what they can out of the king crab. Actually, out of any of the crab, but you could really tell it since the king crab is such a money maker. That was a prime target for the fishermen. And and the other problem was as the crab resource, started diminishing. The fish and game folks started setting timelines that you could go out there and fish in. I mean, they might have just a 24-hour opening or a 3-day opening or a week opening or someone like that. But in those days, weather was not really considered a factor. They would come up, I don't know whoever made those decisions. I'm sure it was boards and everything else that made all those decisions, but these poor guys, when they had an opening, they geared up for it, and it was a one-shot deal for many of them. It was either you go out there and get your crab and come back and be able to pay the bank off and put food. I really felt for these guys, and they went out in some of the worst weather than you can imagine, and some of the vessels that they were going at, you know, we still had the wooden vessels and so on back then. Not as many of them because they were sinking pretty quick. They would get out there in some pretty bad weather. Of course, they'd take these huge, you've seen these big crab pots that they carry, and the more that they would carry, you know, the more chances that they could catch more crab. So they would go out there, many of them overloaded for the sea condition. They'd get out there in some real bad seas and they'd flip over. When you flip over in cold seas like that, they oftentimes didn't have time to get in survival suits and life rafts. And quite frankly, in those days, you didn't have the requirements nor the education. It was also kind of like a machismo thing that was passed on from fishermen to fishermen, I think. That your boat is your home, and that you got to trust in it, and almost like a taboo thing to be having survival suits and stuff around. And many of them go out there without survival suits or life rafts on board.
They thought if they ignored the inevitable or what might happen, that it won't happen.
Right. Yeah. It was called superstition, I guess. So yeah, there was a lot of vessels going down, and they're dotted all around Kodiak. And of course, the only helicopter stations that you had during that time was Sitka and Kodiak. And so between the two stations, you know, oftentimes we'd have to go up to Prince William Sound. There wasn't anything over on the Bristol Bay, and you know, the over on that side. And so we were often even having to go over on that side to do rescues.
So Kodiak would have to cover almost all of the Aleutians and the western part of Alaska.
We were the center point, and if you think about it, all the way up the barrel, we covered probably 75% of Alaska. But the majority of the rescues were centered around Kodiak because this was a real hub for the fishing fleet also. And since then, it's kind of spread out quite a bit, but it's still a majority of it right here. And then you had boats that was transiting during the summertime. The salmon, a lot of the salmon boats would transit up here from Oregon and Washington, and that was a whole new deal too. But getting back to the king crab, because of those openings and bad weather and so on like that, there was a tendency of overloading, and there was a it always seemed that there was going to be a crab opening. It was going to be in the worst weather possible. I don't know who planned it, which weatherman planned it, but it always seemed like it was at the worst time that these folks would go out.
So when your duty day rolled around on the crab opener and the weather got bad, you pretty much knew that you better you're going to get launched.
You knew you were going to get launched, and so yeah, we spent many hours going out searching for bodies and any kind of wreckage and so on like that. We found most of the wreckage. Oftentimes, you didn't find the bodies because they weren't in survival suits. And you've got a whole if you go out here to the bell out in front of the harbor master's office, you can see all the names written on there, and quite a few of them was seemed to be on that tail end of the king crab days.
And quite a few of them you searched for yourself, huh?
Oh yeah.
Is there any names on the bell that stick in your mind, or that certain type of rescue you were on that sticks in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of them on there, and a lot of them were friends of mine. I probably one of the later ones, I guess, was the Wayward Wind down the south part of the island.
The vessel's name was Wayward Wind.
That was the name of the vessel, and he had Baglin and his the crew that was on there. There was four that died, and two survived. Rasmussen was one of the survivors, and that deal, that was one of those cases where they were going out crabbing down the south end of the island, and the kind of loaded down. Sprung a leak, and I believe perhaps the lazarette might have been partially open, and water had washed over, and it kind of started filling it up. And before they knew it, it was too late. They couldn't keep up with it. And, I remember that night. That was one of those dark and stormy nights. 35 knot winds and 10 foot seas, I guess. 10-15 foot seas, pretty choppy. And the first crew that actually went down there, they launched off down there, and there's again the scenario where they got out a good mayday call, and it was oftentimes those mayday calls are passed on, and another vessel finally gets it to where the comm station here, Coast Guard comm station, can pick it up and get the launch started. And the weather was such down there you couldn't hardly see anything down there. It was real rainy and just real crummy conditions down there. And the first helicopter crew and C-130 crew had gone down there, and the helicopter crew searched, and the C-130 crew actually picked up an EPIRB signal. EPIRB, you know, is a battery transmitter that transmits a signal that can be picked up by our satellites that go overhead. But it's also something that our aircraft can hone in on and get a direction and a needle point right to where the source is coming from that transmitter. And it so happened that the survivors, the two survivors on there, were clinging to each other. There was a Rasmussen and a lady fisherman from around here. And she was holding the transmitter, and he was kind of holding her in a buoy, so they're both helping each other out, both in survival suits. But the C-130 came across and couldn't see anything, but would cross over and the needle would swing, and so they had a pretty good fix. And what they did is it came across and dropped smokes, a line of smokes,
flares,
down the flares, down the line. They were, I think, Mark 13s. But it was enough, so the helicopter came around and would follow that line of smokes on there, and was able to find the two and pull them out of the water. And with them being pulled out, they called me, and I went down there and launched down there, and was searching for survivors along with another vessel, I believe the fishing vessel Cougar was down there also. And at that time, then it was just a matter of we were pulling the bodies. And again, when you start knowing people and stuff like that, and you're doing that kind of like really puts it at home. But that was another sad case. They were all guys in survival suits and so on like that. But then again, I show you how cold this water is. They talk about survival suits lasting for 24 hours. Well, that may be, but not in this washing machine kind of environment and cold water type.
Flushes the warmth right away from you.
Sure does. And when you're hot, my theory on that is when you're struggling and you're getting a lot more heat loss from struggling, because those waves will knock you over on your face and you struggle real hard to flapping your arms and swimming to get back up on your back to where you can breathe, plus the water flushing in on the side of your face seal that you've got on the survival suit, I think it takes twice as much heat away from it, just draws it away from it, and you really, your survival time is really, really cut in half, whatever it might have been if it was a calm.
And when you get, when you arrive on scene where these people are, a lot of times they're not able to help themselves get in the rescue device, or what would you do if you come across a person that was in the water, and when you lowered the basket by the hoist to pick these people out of the water, what would you do if they couldn't get in themselves at that time?
Yeah, those times, and we didn't have rescue swimmers. And of course, since those days, we got the rescue swimmers just because of that, because when, like you say, people get hypothermic and lose the dexterity and are unable to help themselves because of cold water, yet you have to help them. And in those days, we would put somebody in a survival suit. One of our crewmen would volunteer one of them. It's usually the radio man, the avionics man, because the guy operating the hoist, you know, sorry, I need to operate the hoist. And so it was kind of a foregone conclusion who was going to get in there. But you offered them to volunteer, and of course they always did. And they would get a survival suit, and they'd tie a tagline to them, and try to get down below 5 feet and let them jump in the water and swim over the guy, and then you put the basket down, and they get into the basket and bring them back up. I had a couple of cases like that worked out real well doing that. But,
any particular one that sticks in your mind that you had extra difficulties with?
Yeah, I had a lot of with difficulties. Let's see, I had one case up there near Cordova where these two guys were bringing one of these salmon seiners up from Oregon, and they got themselves in 45 knot winds, and the seas were 30 feet, just real nasty, and the thing was breaking apart, and they were taking on water, and the engine had quit, and they were quickly getting blown into what they call a kayak island. It was a long island, and so they called out their mayday. And we started flying there at night, and about two-thirds of the way across, before we got to Kayak Island, we started picking up ice on there. And
ice on the helicopter?
Ice on the helicopter. And and a lot of snow and stuff on that, and Loran went about
your
30
positioning,
Loran was about 30 miles off from where we were. We thought we were doing a pretty good line across there, and thought that Loran was working okay. That's the problem, but Loran oftentimes wouldn't just go on the blink and just say off. It would slowly move you 20, 30 miles. Of course, you're setting out over ocean and don't have any landmarks to see. You're kind of relying on this idiot box and hoping that it's reliable.
So you show up in Cordova and you're supposed to be in Valdez or something.
Well, the only thing I remember is that when you time and distance wise, that we were getting close to Kayak and they were about 2 miles just to the south of Kayak, drifting towards the wind blowing them towards. So we were kind of in a hurry to get there because they were drifting into the rocks on there. And so the only thing I remember was that there's a about 150 foot tall rock on the one end of it, and then you had the lighthouse station sitting right across from that, and you had in between the rock and the cliff of the island where that at the bottom of where that station was, you had yourself about 150 foot, 200 feet of space to go through. And the only thing I can remember is seeing the lighthouse flashing on the left side of us, and going right between the rock and saying,
when you're
we're pretty darn lucky because we didn't see it.
So your rotor diameter is some 60 some feet.
Yeah, that was a real eye opener. That again, that was right after that we were able to talk the Coast Guard and giving us Omega to kind of help us out, because that was pretty scary. But when we were having real problems with the radio communications with the vessel, and when we finally found them, we did a low pass. We were only flying about 50 feet off the water.
Is that because of the ceiling? Because
the ceilings were down, and just for the visibility to be able to see anything, we had to be down that. But so we went across them, and we saw them, and we had turned on the nose light to make a turn back around. As soon as that nose light hit, and again the snow showers starts coming at you, I got immediate vertigo, and again was like a drunken pilot. I mean, I just had no my head was spinning, and I felt like I was falling. And
so what do you do when you get vertigo? What did you do at that time?
What I did is I tried to act as calm as I could and made it look like that I wanted my co-pilot to set things up while I rested a little bit. Again, it's a confidence game. You don't like to get first of all, you don't want to tell people how close you came to running into a rock, and then you don't want to make matters worse by telling them you got vertigo. And so it was basically, hey, you know, take the controls and make the turn around here, and we'll set up here. Meanwhile, I was just had my eyes pinned to all the instruments, trying to regain my head from spinning while he was making the turns and stuff around. It worked out pretty good. Once we got down, we got to a hover. And of course, when you got turbulent type winds on there, the helicopter's bouncing all around. And then when you've got the seas bouncing around in a different direction than what the winds are doing, you've got yourself a real mix master. And he's moving one direction while you're moving in another direction. And so you've got to put this basket down on this little bitty deck that's tossing around, and off of a little small quarter inch diameter steel cable that can go up about 240 feet. And so it's all a real timing game, and that's one of those deals that I thought the Coast Guard were masters of, in this coordination between the flight mechanic that's running the hoist behind you, and the pilot up front, because he's doing what we call con, where he's talking you into getting in a position, at least trying to. When you're both bouncing all over, it could be real frustrating, but guys really get good at it. And so after 4 or 5 attempts of trying to get this basket on the vessel, and right before it was hit the rocks, we were able to get these two guys off and bring them off the vessel. And you always think, wow, once I got the guys off the vessel, you say, man, it's great. You know, it's time to go get a beer and relax and let somebody else take the duty. Well, the only problem was that we didn't have enough fuel to make it back to Kodiak, and we were closer into Cordova. But we had a crummy, we knew we didn't have a Loran. So it was all a matter of, again, time and distance and trying to find some type of landmark, you know, pitch black out there, snowing and wind blowing and running out of fuel. And so it was a matter of and icing up. So we had about a quarter inch of ice built up on the windshield. And so it was a real opaque and you couldn't see out very well, but you could out your side window. So the co-pilot did a real good job on kind of trying to pinpoint where we were, and we would get down about 25 feet off the ground and find landmarks and stuff as we just slowed down and picked away across to Cordova and finally landed. But it took about 5 minutes for these guys to find them a bottle and put themselves to sleep. I think that was the last time they volunteered to bring a vessel up, So we had a lot of those kind of things. Again, that was the unknown, flying out to the unknown and picking up problems and so on like that. And we always seemed on every case to have some kind of problem that we had to do something different on.
I understand that you landed in the water one time in really rough conditions. Was that at night or?
Yeah. That was a case in December. I believe that was like in 86. And we had a vessel that called a Mayday down in the south part of the island at Shelcoff Straits. And they got caught in a storm again. And that was early morning launch around, I guess we got up about 4 o'clock in the morning. And the problem on that side of the island is that you had to go through well pass and so on, because we had the low ceilings again and it was raining real hard, and the winds were 50 knots around here, which made it real turbulent. And that's where I got my first crack across my helmet, was from hitting severe turbulence and cracked the top of my helmet.
Was that violent?
Yeah, and it was bad enough that you really couldn't hold on to the controls. You're better off just letting it trimming it up and keeping your hands nearby. And when the helicopter was like going up on the side, then you'd have to make a control movement. But once we got through that pass and we got through Raspberry through the straits on there, we were able to. It was a little bit better. And so we started heading down south on the middle of the Shelcock, and the radios were real scratchy. We got, you know, within 20 miles of where they said, thought they were. And a lot of times when their vessels are breaking up, they have the same kind of navigation problems that we do. But there was two brothers. They were the Stephen brothers, and I remember that they had bought a vessel and were taking it down to Sand Point. And so when we were able to talk to them, it was breaking up and so on like that. And the seas down there, when you're talking about 30 or 40 foot seas, and you're talking about a 36, 38 foot seiner, the bottom of the trough, you would just lose the signal. And when we're sitting down that low because of the ceiling, It was very difficult to get a good signal to where you could get a needle swing and find where we knew we were in the right vicinity, because we were within 20 miles anyways, because we wouldn't have been able to pick up the signal transmission if we weren't. So as the voices, transmissions got a little bit louder, what we'd asked them to do was we asked them to shoot off a flare. And they shot off a flare, and that's how we actually located them, was when we spotted the flare and went over there. And by that time, the storm had picked up, and we were getting 80-knot winds. And, I mean, it was, the seas were really, really ugly, and they were 40 feet. And
I think a lot of people don't realize how hard that would be to fly in 80-knot winds. That must be really particularly hard.
Yeah, it was, especially with seas and stuff like that, and they were you know, they were coming over the south part of the island, and it causes the wind to tumble. So it wasn't just straight wind; it was a tumbling type wind. And again, you had that mixed master situation where the vessel was going, but the vessel was actually breaking up. It had a couple of all the antennas, and it had a couple of stabilizers on it that were broken into, and they're. Engine was burning up. They were having a hard time keeping it into the wind, so when I talked to them, they went it off really, really quick, because they couldn't. The rudder had broken, and they would go way completely over on the side, and it didn't look like they were going to come up, and then it'd come up, something else would break off, and so one of the brothers went back on the aft deck. And what we do is on something like that is that we would have a trail line. It was just a polyurethane rope, and it would have weight bags on one end, and the other end you would have what we call the weak link that would that you could attach it to the basket. And so when the basket was going down, even though the boat was rocking and rolling, the crewman could help pull that over to the vessel, and you wouldn't have to worry about it penduluming and slamming into the vessel and breaking your hoist. So we had discussed that with one of the Stephen brothers, and they were prepared to do that. But when you talk about 80 knot winds, you're talking about the when you put the trail line out, it would go way behind the helicopter. If the helicopter pilot really needs to see the vessel, needs to see something to have some kind of reference to be able to hold the aircraft kind of steady and fly formation with the vessel, just like flying formation with an airplane. You got to see that in order to keep good formation. If you don't and lose target, you're completely depending upon the flight mech to be able to con you, which is okay, except usually he's 1-2 seconds behind of what maybe action might need when you're in that kind of situation, bad seas and so on like that. So that's not the best situation. So what we did is we took our anchor and we tied it to the trail line.
Your anchor for the helicopter?
Yeah. And he lowered that down and was able to get it onto the vessel. And this weak link is a 300-pound breaking strength line that's attached from the trail line to the hoist cable. And what that does is if there's 300-pound jerk, it will break away so you don't damage the hoist cable or the hoist itself. It's what that's intended for. Well, the person we put down there, he started pulling the basket and it broke. And that weak link broke. And so then we had some weight bags that we put on another trail line, and we tried it and it broke. And so basically we had run out of trail lines. It took us a while to get these things on there anyways, so we would get pretty frustrated, pretty tired, get pretty
fatigued. It must be pretty challenging for you to hold that hover for that long. Also.
Exactly. It was a constant moving on there, and a lot of concentration, a lot of sweat trying to get this thing on. because you also got a mass that's sitting there swinging up underneath the helicopter, and the helicopter is being pushed up and down because of the, of the turbulent weather. So you're constantly dodging his mass that's trying to cut you in half and put you in the water with him. So that's kind of was always in the back of your mind. You're always trying to keep that from happening. So we decided we'd try it without the trail line, because we didn't have any trail lines left. And we put it down, and of course the wind caught it like a sail, and it was flying behind the tail rotor. And so I'd be flying way in front of the vessel, and the flight mech, which was his first, that was his first rescue case.
So he was very green under it.
So he was green, but he was doing a good job. And we did get it on the vessel, which was kind of surprising. And then he backed me up. Once he was on the vessel, he backed me up, and I was able to fly formation with the vessel. And he noticed the fray in the hoist cable, and with the fray, with some of the strands of steel broken on the cable, he was worried that would snap once we started bringing these guys up. And so we discussed it and took the basket off the deck, which was real disheartening. All that work to get it on there, and now we had to take it off. Brought it back up, and we cut the cable where it had frayed. And we have what we call a quick splice. A quick splice piece of is like a metal block about twice the size of a Hershey bar. And it's got holes that are drilled in various locations on that bar. And you thread the cable back and through these holes. And on this block of metal is another hook that you could snap on. And so that was what we call a quick splice. And we were able to put the hoist back to good use using the basket again. So we were really getting tired. We were running out of fuel. We just had enough fuel. We figured we could make it down to Sitkanak, where that's the island that's south of Kodiak, and that's where we have a fuel cache. We have a fuel tank there that we can land there and get some fuel that we can have enough to make it back in the city of Kodiak. So we were at that point that running out of fuel like that, we needed to get something happening here, and we spent such a long time on getting this thing on. I like to pull people off of life. And so with the life raft, it makes it a lot easier. You can get down a lot closer to it, and it makes flying it a lot easier. And so I had asked, I said, you know, do you have a life raft on board? And they said, yes. And I said, well, look, what I want you to do is get in your survival suits, tie off with each other with a rope, deploy the life raft, both of you go in and get in the life raft, and I'll hoist you out of the life raft. And I said, okay. And it wasn't more than 30 seconds that both brothers were out on the stern of the deck, and they were both carrying bundles of something, and they were in survival suits, and they both jumped in. And I thought, great, this is going to be good. Now that they're in the water, they're going to deploy the life raft, and they're going to get in. Well, the life raft never deployed, and these two bundles that they were carrying soon left their arms, and they were just flailing in the water and struggling in the water. And I'm thinking, gee whiz, this is not like the plan that we had discussed. But on the other hand, they were in the water, and it like a life raft, but I didn't have to worry about the mast. And so I said, no sweat. We'll just put the basket in there, and they can easily swim to the basket or get it close by him, and they can get in there. And I can let out enough slack and back off from the basket, and I can watch them and keep that helicopter pretty steady, you know, other than the winds bouncing me around. But as long as I could see him, I could fly formation with him. And that was working out real good. And they had swam over to the basket. Both of them got into the basket, and I was saying, man, this is a done deal. And moved back up to them and started bringing them up. And they got halfway up to the helicopter, about 15 feet, and darn it if the cable didn't break.
So it must. What was the cable strength? How much could it take?
Well, the cable was for 600 pounds, and so, you know, it was probably a 5,000 pound cable, but that's what there was some struts and stuff on the apparatus for the hoist that 600 pounds was always supposed to carry. But it broke right down there at that.
The weak link, or the
we had splice? That splice and stuff going on there, and they're back down in the water. Well, here we are without trail lines, and we didn't have a basket or anything, and the flight mech had brought the cable all the way up and it wound around where we couldn't get to it anymore because he was worried about it going back into the tail rotor. So what are you going to do? The only thing that we had practiced and done before was this rough water landing in the water.
Have you ever done that in those kind of seas before?
Never in that kind of seas. I had done it a couple of times in some calmer seas, but in these kind of seas, you wouldn't even, normally you wouldn't think about it. Yeah. Of course, you never practice it. The only time you practice it was out here in calm water. I thought, well, that's it. Get out this platform. Platform is a wire, kind of almost a square platform that you stick outside the door, and it's attached to the floor of the exit cargo door where you would have brought them in normally with that hoist.
Kind of like a step then, or
yeah, something you could go out on and step out on. And so that's what we were going to do. I was going to get parallel with the seas, and I was going to get to where the winds were just hitting me off the front left side, I guess port we should call it, of the helicopter. And as soon as the top of the wave would come up, I was going to sit down on the wave and right next to the two guys and pick them up, which was a lot easier said than done. And I remember the first time we had landed there and timing that just right to where we'd get down there, and the co-pilot was, of course, the waves were coming right at the co-pilot from his side, and when it got too close for comfort, he would say up, 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 and we would immediately have to lift up. And so he did that about three times. We'd get right down there about 2 feet from him, and up, 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 and before the wave would slap us, which we got a couple of times. It did hit us. And the concern there is a wave hitting the tail rotor would have flipped us, or if it would have gone into the engine intake, would have knocked an engine out. We would have all been in the water. And it did ride like a boat in the water because the helicopter is so top heavy. So the third or fourth try, we did get right down next to him. As a matter of fact, I landed on top of one of the brothers. And that's the fourth time I had to get up because the flight mech says, you're on top, you know, of them, up, up, up. And so it was getting real hard to get this down. And to tell you the truth, I was just playing beat.
Mentally and physically?
Mentally and physically. I was just playing wore out. But you could tell that they were, they had about had it. They had stopped struggling. The hypothermia had already set in. They weren't able to swim anymore. One of the suits had opened and had water in it. And you could tell. In fact, the one brother had his hands clasped and was praying to get him. But they had just, I think they had pretty much lost hope. It was really, you could just see it. We were that close to him, yet that far from him. And so I told the crew, well, again, you know, we didn't have any fuel either at this point. and being so tired, we would just, every time we landed in the water, it was your chances of getting swamped increased. And
that must be very frustrating for an aircraft commander as yourself, is you know you really want to do this, but you're looking out for your crew also and thinking, am I going to put these guys in more jeopardy by landing again?
Well, that's it. And of course, a lot of the crew members thought maybe in past cases that I had pushed too far anyways, but a lot of that came from past experiences from the Iceland flying and so on like that, that I felt pretty comfortable in doing it and really wasn't that concerned with it. But in this particular instance, I was getting concerned. I was so concerned that I was, my conscious was talking to my subconscious, which had never happened before, and I said, hey, this is awfully strange, and I'm sitting here talking to myself right in the middle of doing this case here, and it was kind of like the devil sitting on one shoulder and the angel sitting on this shoulder and saying, hey, you know, one was telling me, you got to think about your crew and yourself, and the other one was saying, hey, you know, what about these two guys in the water? But that was a real tough decision I had to make then. I couldn't do it anymore, and so we had one more chance. I told the crew we were going to do one more chance, and that was it. And then we're going to have to we're going to have to leave on there. So we got on top of the crest. This what I was going to do this time was going to land on top of the crest with them in the trough, and then I was just going to slide down the side of the wave and get down in the trough with them and try to pick them up on the downside of the wave. And so that's what we did. We landed on top and then slid down the backside of the wave and got down there, and we did grab them. Had three crewmen in the back. I had a corpsman back there and our radio avionics man and our hoist flight mechanic. And so all three of them were back there, and they all three grabbed these two guys, and they weren't able to pull them in because their suits, survival suits, had filled up with gallons of water. I mean, it was like a big water balloon on that. And
it's terrible.
And so I asked my co-pilot to go back there and give them a hand. So there's four of them back there struggling, and meanwhile I had lifted back up.
Your co-pilot went there?
Yeah.
So that left you alone in the cockpit with no one looking out the left side, actually. So it was pretty, but there's no other way to get this guy out.
Yeah, and once we got him on the platform where they were hanging on there just with their arms and people grabbing them, I was looking through the side mirror, and I had lifted back up above the waves there, and I was looking in the side mirror and acting like a cheerleader on there. Actually, I was screaming support to them on there, and actually had the mic keyed. They were listening to it back in Kodiak, I guess. So they were giving me a hard time when I got back. They were back. It looked like a wrestling tag team match. I mean, they had people by the heads and underneath their crotch and everything, trying to pull these guys in. It took them a good 5 minutes to finally get them in. If you can imagine doing a tug of war.
So we were in the air at this time and you're hovering above the waves, and they were hanging on to the outside of the platform?
They were all hanging on the outside, and it was kind of scary too, because a couple of them didn't have their belts on. You know, they didn't have anything. They could have just as easily gone out the door, and we would have
been in that situation again.
Situation the same thing. So I was a little leery about that, but that was the only thing we could do. After about 5 minutes, they kind of like a rubber band, they all shot back in and rolled to the back of the helicopter. Co-pilot got back up to his seat and then started taking care of the guys, getting them out of the suits and treating them for hypothermia. So we started heading to Sikkenek to our refueler. And I was just beat. I just didn't have anything left in me anymore. And I asked the co-pilot, who was this guy? His name was Filipowicz. He was a real good guy. So he took the controls and was taking us to Sitkinak. And about 5 minutes later, he says, hey, Tom, take the controls back, and why don't you fly? I thought, well, that's pretty nerdy. I mean, but he must really be tired from that struggle in the back. So I took it again, and about 3 minutes, I realized, I said, hey, John, we don't have enough fuel tanks to sit in that. He said, yeah, that's what I thought. That's why I gave the controls back, because I didn't think so either. So what we did, we instead of going into the wind like we were going, that would really slow us down in 80-knot winds, we turned around and just shot across Shelikov Straits. I mean, we only had about 15 minutes of fuel left. I mean, we were sucking fumes at that time. And but we were, with that 80-knot wind, I mean, we were making some time going across the straits there. And the first piece of land, of course, it was so foggy and rainy and windy and so on, all we saw was just this little island. I don't know, it was about twice the size of a helicopter, but that's all we needed. So we landed down on it and shut down the aircraft. And
what did you do as far as, did you have to declare a emergency that you had to land, and then that must have alerted the people back in Kodiak?
Yeah, they had a C-130 that they were going to launch out of there, but the winds were that they didn't. They got to us after we had landed, after the case getting them out of the water. Again, they weren't able to come down through the clouds because it was only about 7,500 foot ceilings. I mean, really low ceilings, and they couldn't come down. But after we, this is like 2.5 hours later when we landed on the island. The CO, Captain Cunningham, had sent C-130 over to find us, and they actually came down below and just got knocked all over the place. And they were going to send another helicopter out to pick us up, but airplane pilot said, no, you don't want anybody to come over here until the thing's blown through, and talk them out of that. So, I don't know, 5-6 hours later that afternoon, they brought another helicopter out to pick us up, took us back to Kodiak.
What were the conditions of your survivors? Were they...
They were really really hypothermic on there. Of course, all their adrenaline rush was over with, but we had them in bags, and the corpsman did a good job and gave them fluids and so on like that, and just treated them and started bringing their temperature slowly back up. We were pretty concerned about the slurry speech and so on like that, and we were a little concerned, but again, Captain Nimrock had taught everybody about hypothermia and cold water drowning, and that was his corpsman, so they did a real good job on bringing these guys' temperatures back up, and so they were quite excited about being alive. But the deal was, I'd ask them, I said, well, how come you didn't put your survival raft overboard and get in it? And he says, I couldn't hear you. I couldn't hear a word that you were saying across the radio because it was so loud. The engines were burning up. It was causing all kinds of noise on that. And he said, just didn't hear you. I heard the word overboard and jumped in the water. And he didn't even think about getting into his life raft. And the suits, of course, filled up with water. And that was the problem with the hoist breaking when we had them up there. They must have weighed 1,000 pounds, and with the jerking motion that the winds were causing, when that wire cable turned around its first point, we figured that was enough to weaken it and snap it. So, they're doing fine, they write, and they're doing okay.
So you must have felt a great relief along with the crew when you landed and you were safe on the ground.
Oh, yeah, and it didn't take me long at all to just fall asleep. I mean, I was beat. I just kind of like passed out there for a half hour, and I was messed up. I was pretty beat.
That was some sour case. I imagine you received some type of award for this, huh?
Yeah, we were. I've been pretty lucky in that respect up here in Kodiak. It seemed like all the Kodiak folks or Sitka crews were always going to awards, and so it was always nice to, because that gave you an opportunity to get down to someplace a little warmer during the winter or whatever, and enjoy the festivities. But the Navy Helicopter Association, I had won that three times and got an opportunity to go down for the regional thing, and then also then go for the national deal. And American Helicopter Society, it seems like there's a whole lot of organizations that
really like to jump on the bandwagon.
That like the treat us pretty good. So that was a lot of fun to be able to get down there and do some of those things.
That's great. So you did receive a Distinguished Flying Cross with Valor for that SAR case, I understand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Sitting here in your office, I see all these awards on your wall, and I'm sure there's many more SAR cases that you'd like to talk about, or I'd like to hear from you. But.
Yeah, we'd be here for the next, probably for a week, telling these tall tales. What I've seen over the years, the vessels have been getting newer on here. The fishermen wives around here really got involved, and the hypothermia, cold water grounding, wearing a survival suit, those kind of things. The wives would go out and buy their husband's survival suits, and now you see crewmen and skippers training their crews, and of course that's turning into becoming a law, but you got organizations that'll go around and train the people. So you see them now having the survival suits, having the life rafts on board, and actually going through drills and understanding when to make call the mayday calls, when to start getting into a survival mode and getting out of the save my boat mode. Which most of the time, you know, you're only talking minutes, because talking about the guy's livelihood going down to the bottom of the sea. So, but things have gotten better, but the seas are still bad, and they're still sinking out there, and the dangers are still there. And while I was here, we lost three aircraft. Of course, the aircraft I came up here for, that crew, and then we had one that flew into the side of mountain on an island off Chiniac, and we had a C-130 that crashed inside of a mountain. So those are reminders about how dangerous it is out there, and I think that's something else that we've come a long ways too in our training with the Coast Guard, and so with the safety and the training seems to have gotten increased, things have gotten a little bit better. Now if the weather would only cooperate, would be in real good shape.
Well, that's good. Well, this will conclude our interview today, and I'm really happy that you could share this time with me, take time out of your schedule to go over this with me. I appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime. I enjoyed it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.